This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
This is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast, this time in the offices of Druva with W. Curtis Preston. Hey, Curtis.
Hey, Chris.
How you doing?
Doing all right.
Good, good. So you are Chief Technologist at Druva.
Right.
What does that really mean as a job title then? What do you do?
Well, it means I, you know, understand the technology. I talk a lot internally to, you know, sort of provide my expertise into the product side of things.
Yep.
As well as, you know, my biggest visible role, of course, is being an evangelist and explaining the technology to other technologists.
And that's exactly the reason why you and I are here today
to
talk this through. And to be honest, the reason I thought it would be great to catch up is because I look back and it's 2 years since I spoke to Jaspreet. I think a lot of things have happened since then.
It's been a big 2 years.
There's been a lot of evolution of the technology within the company. And I think after, as well, and just to give everybody else a bit of background, you presented not that long ago at a Tech Field Day, mm-hmm. which was actually a bit of an interesting scenario because you were poacher turned gamekeeper or gamekeeper turned poacher, whichever way around it is.
At the time, I was brand new to the role.
Right, yeah. So you were, anyway, you were up at the front presenting to us
rather
than listening to what was going on.
Right.
Now, one of the very interesting messages that came out of that discussion was the way that Druva uses the cloud. Mm-hmm. And it's a very different model. And I think I wanted to just really get that piece understood so that everybody listening can understand what that means, but also just to understand where the company's going and where it's headed. And just to add one little piece into that, I've done a lot of stuff recently on analytics and discovery and so on, and the ability to have that in the cloud seems to me like that gives a great option for companies like Druva to sell a service around that. So I would like to talk about that as well, because
absolutely.
I think that's a really interesting part of the market. So let's just start by giving some background on the company and the products, because I think that will help people sort of understand how the company's evolved to where it is today.
Yeah, so 10 years ago, we were a company selling on-prem data protection software, specifically towards endpoints.
Yeah.
And several years ago, we made the biggest pivot towards cloud, right? And we said we saw the cloud as the future, right? And specifically, when we say the cloud, we mean the public cloud, right? And we decided to do something that at that time seemed a little crazy, right? We designed our infrastructure for the cloud, right? We designed it specifically. We picked a partner at the time. It seemed clear that Amazon was doing well.
And they seemed to be doing well.
They seemed to continue to be doing well.
Yeah.
And we programmed specifically to the AWS architecture and how they run, which is very different than what we could have done. We could have taken our existing on-prem solution and just ran it in VMs in the cloud, which is what our competitors are doing today.
Yeah.
But we decided to do something very different and actually program to the AWS way of doing things.
Right. Okay. So we'll come back and we'll talk about what that actually means in a second. But so the products that you started with were end user, endpoint protection,
endpoint protection.
So when we see that with meaning things like laptops and so on.
Right.
Yeah. And then the company then, I wouldn't say pivoted, you added additional functionality to go after enterprise workloads.
Right. Yeah, so about 3 years ago, I think, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we added in the functionality to start backing up data centers.
Okay.
And then the most recent addition, about a year ago, we acquired the ability to do cloud-native workloads.
Right. So effectively, if you're an enterprise, you can look at any of the components that you might have data on,
mm-hmm.
devices that are out in the field or even sitting on a desktop in the office, stuff that you've got in your own data center, and then now, obviously, as people are looking at public cloud and may have a hybrid operation, you can back that up as well.
Right. And then also one thing we didn't mention when we talk about endpoint data, we also mean SaaS workloads. So Office 365, G Suite, Salesforce.
That's counted as endpoint, is it, in that definition?
Well, it's end user.
Right. Okay. I see what you mean. Yeah. I think that's one that sometimes gets missed out, actually, in the discussion, that whole idea of backing up SaaS solutions. Because as we know, solutions like Office 365
mm-hmm.
do not get backed up for your benefit. They get backed up for the benefit of recovering the infrastructure.
We could spend the rest of this podcast arguing that particular topic.
I think, absolutely.
We do it on a regular basis, right? Yeah, it does get forgotten about.
Yeah, good. Okay, so now we know the product range. I think it'd be great to get into a bit more detail about what it means to run on the public cloud. So let me set the scene and then you can, you know, explain how you see it. It seems pretty reasonable that if you've got a software product that runs on-prem today, mm-hmm. you could just lift and shift it into the cloud. You could, run it as an instance, back up the data. Now, First thing I would see there is that there may be some challenges around networking and some other pieces, but theoretically it can work. However, that's not the way that Druva went about it, is it?
Right. No, it's the thing about backup, and the reason why I think it lends itself so well to the cloud way of doing things, is that it's a dynamic workload, right? Your backups only run for a very peak load, for a very short period of time of the day. The rest of the time, you have, you know, your resources go completely unused. So when you do a lift and shift,
yeah,
you're basically renting a car all day long, but only driving it for 20 minutes.
That's a really interesting thing to think about, because mm-hmm. if you look at any of us who've been in this space for any length of time, we know that we would build both a backup infrastructure for, as you said, for that window of backup,
right,
which usually was overnight. But secondly, we would build for the peak.
Right.
So we'd end
you
up
have to build for the peak.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you'd end up putting on a huge amount of infrastructure on the floor that actually not only might not be used during the day, but might not actually be used most of the week, depending
exactly.
on your methodology.
Yeah, if you look at the number of hours that the backup infrastructure is actually being actively used, it's really small.
Yeah.
But that made sense in a data center. But when you're doing it in a cloud where you're renting things by the minute, it doesn't make sense anymore.
Yeah. So your architecture uses cloud native services.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we mean by that in that sense? How does the architecture sort of consume the services that the cloud providers offer?
Yeah, so the first big one, and as you know, the listeners listening to me describe this, they go, well, why do I care? And the first answer is, think about the cost aspect of each thing that we're doing. And
as we go along the discussion, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously we're using EC2, right? But unlike, you know, our competitors that are where the backup server is running 24/7, we run EC2 instances as necessary.
Right.
So we're dynamically scaling up and down throughout the day in order to give that peak load when it's needed, but to basically scale down to almost nothing when it's not needed. An important thing I should mention in the very beginning, this is all running in our account, not the customer's account. Right?
Yeah, we'll get back to that, because I think that's
an important differentiator.
And that's something we should cover in a bit more detail. But yeah, let's park that one. We'll come back to that, because that's really important.
So the EC2 instances are, we run as many of them as we need when we need it, and then we scale down to nothing dynamically throughout the day, right?
Yeah.
And that just automatically happens based on the customer load that's happening at that time.
Right.
Then, and the same is true, those instances serve two purposes. One is authentication and authorization. The other is the actual storage movement portion, right? These are two different kinds of instances, and we may need more or less of each, right? And those are scaling up and down throughout the day.
Right.
Then the next thing is we have to store things, right? We are, you know, a data protection company, right? So you have data and you have metadata. We store data in the least expensive way you can store it in the cloud, which is an S3.
Yep.
Right?
Object store.
The least or the most expensive S3 is half the price of the least expensive EBS. Right?
Yeah.
And so we store it in S3. The metadata, which for our case is two kinds of metadata. One is files and names and servers and where and
all
what
the objects you've backed up.
Right.
Yeah.
The other is the fact that we're doing global deduplication across the entire environment. So it's also the hashed values, right?
Okay.
All that metadata gets stored in DynamoDB, which is a key value pair, giantly scalable database provided by Amazon.
Natively provided by Amazon. Yeah.
And then configuration information, we store that in RDS, which again is another service provided by Amazon. That's an example of the kind of thing that we're talking about. And in S3, for example, because we're using S3, we can natively take advantage of the cheaper versions of S3 as our customers need us to.
Over time, yeah.
Yeah.
So if I drew a sort of visual picture or mental picture, however you want to think about it, you've got S3, which you're basically charging. You get I hope it's not on your credit card account, but Druva personally get charged for usage. Pure and simple. That's just a capacity usage issue.
Right.
And then you can auto-tier around, you know, the different versions of that as you see fit. But you're paying only for that capacity that you need.
Right.
And then when you step up to the higher levels of things like the metadata, RDS, as you mentioned, and DynamoDB, again, the charging is only based on usage at that point and capacity that you're using within those platforms.
Exactly. And the same with AC2, right?
Yeah.
So, and the way we do that is we just amortize all of that across all the customers.
Yeah.
And what we end up billing the customer is a single number per month, which is based on the number of deduplicated gigabytes stored in S3.
Yeah. So you basically you massage all of the costs to come out with the blended cost that the customer then pays on that basis.
Right.
Now, one other thing I've just thought of that is really interesting with the idea of the ability to spin up and spin down the instances as you choose is that as Amazon brings out new technology and new instances and new types of instance, you can use those pretty much immediately.
Yeah, a perfect example of that would be Snowball Edge, right? So as tight as we are with Amazon, when Snowball Edge was coming out, we already had it in our hands, right? And what we did was we used it to solve one of our challenges, which given that we are a straight-to-cloud backup model, there is that first backup, the seed, right?
Yes.
So we, the moment Snowball Edge was available, which is Snowball plus compute is what Snowball Edge is, for those that don't know. We were able to create a product, as I make quotes in the air because we don't charge for it, where customers, Phoenix customers, can go in and say they have X number of terabytes of data. They're going to need three Snowball Edges. They get shipped directly to them. All they have to do is plug them in and start backing up to them. And then they ship them back to Amazon, and Amazon uploads that data into the cloud. And all of that's included as part of their cost.
And then you just work out that you know which customer that relates to. Then you make sure that data is mapped
into
that customer.
Yeah, it's all included because it's our code, you know, on the SBE, Snowball Edge, the Druva technology on there. So when it goes back up, it's essentially like shipping one of our servers up there.
Okay. So ultimately, that gives you the scalability that other solutions wouldn't have.
Right.
But we said a few minutes ago that this all runs out of your account.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could look at it and say, well, for other reasons, people might say, well, that's inherently insecure because, you know, that's a shared account and that could be a risk. It could be that in order to do things like networking and other challenges around that, when you map networking to a particular client who might be running an AWS, there are challenges there. What's the sort of methodology you get around that problem?
Yeah, so the funny thing is, I got news for you. All of AWS is a shared resource, right? But it's a valid point, right? So, which is why we encrypt everything that is sent to us, right? We use TLS on the way, and then we use AES 256 on the back end, right?
Yep.
We never have the keys, right? The customer, basically, we use envelope encryption, which at the very end of that is a username and an account that's associated with multiple usernames and accounts, right, that are associated with that. That allows us to store the data using envelope encryption in a way that we can never see it, even if, you know, like, I don't know, Patriot Act or whatever scary thing you want to use, the government holds a gun to our head. There's nothing we can do to give access to customers' data.
Okay.
So that, I think that's, let's just say we run in, I know you're from, you know, another country and all.
I am.
Have this thing called GovCloud here, where there's a government version. So we, part of our product, not all of it, but part of our product runs in GovCloud.
Okay.
Right. So it's been blessed by, you know, as many security type things as you can think of.
Yeah. And that's a really funny comment, isn't it, about AWS as a shared service for everybody?
Right.
Because we get this mental image that we're sort of told that if you've got a separate account, it'll be secure, and we sort of come to sort of just accept that if we run our own account, that somehow we are in a little isolated bubble and not running on shared infrastructure, which of course is just not true.
It's just not true.
Yeah, which is quite, I think that's quite funny, really. Here's another angle I think that's worth reflecting on as part of the fact that you run in the public cloud. If you've got customers, and so just going back actually to think about the conversation I had with Jaspreet a couple of years ago, one of the things we talked about was the geography of the way that customers might be set up.
Right.
So if you were running a single data center, then he said at the time it may well not be that the platform was suited to that environment because if you're sucking all the data out of one data center into the cloud, that might be a problem.
Right.
Now, we now know that Snowball Edge is there to help that initial piece. But actually, I would say that depending on the size of customer, more customers now are probably distributing their compute. And that's certainly going to be the case with edge computing.
Yep.
And then, so what we're going to see is we're going to see a much more distributed backup requirement coming along that would be much more suited to the cloud.
Yeah. I would say the more and more distributed your environment is, the more our model is the only one that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? Otherwise, you're going to be buying boxes from the other guys and putting them in all of your data centers, which then you have to maintain, right? But, and speaking of distributed, so, you know, we say we're in Amazon. What we mean is we're in Amazon regions, right? So we are in, I believe, I'm going to say, I'll just say almost as a qualifier, but almost, at least almost every region that Amazon offers, right? So if you are in a place where you want to stay within a geographical thing, like you want to be in Germany and you want to stay within Germany, you use that region. They just started offering a region in Bahrain, right? And so now we're there, right? So we can handle that part of the world with a region that is close to them.
I had a discussion with another company, slightly different, storage related, but different. And one of the things that scenario came up about the idea about how you're running different data centers. In that instance, it was a Google Cloud discussion, but obviously it applies equally here. And that's because you run with the native services, mm-hmm. effectively, you almost just need to do a blueprint build every time a new region comes in.
That's what
you already know the components that are there.
Yeah.
So for you to actually spin up in that local location is incredibly quick because you are using the native services, supporting that environment isn't actually that difficult as long as all of those services are available, which of course they're going to be because they're pretty standard services.
Yeah, there are regions where all the services aren't available.
Yeah, okay.
Right? So we can't be in those regions, right? There are some regions where some of the services that we need aren't available. So that's one of the reasons I say it's not all the regions.
Right. So what happens if somebody says, I want to back up in, where we are today, the West Coast mm-hmm. of the US, but I'm going to be doing restores in the East Coast, or I want to bring back data in the UK. Mm-hmm. Is that practical to do, or is that something that you haven't sort of approached yet?
I think, you know, you brought in the UK there, right? So if it's East Coast, West Coast, I wouldn't think it would be a big deal. I would think that if you're a European organization, you would probably be using a European region to back up to. Can you restore to that other area? Sure, we can restore from anywhere to anywhere. Is it something you would want to do as a matter of course all the time? Possibly not, right?
Yeah,
I think you want to use the region closest to you for lots of reasons.
Yeah, I think it's unlikely you'd want to go down that route, but obviously there might be a scenario where people decide to do workload shifting or, you know, one-off movements, and if they know they can use your technology to do that.
Yeah, we can absolutely do that. We use it for workload mobility as well.
You already use it for that?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. So here's a few questions I think that are worth challenging you on in mm-hmm. terms of the cloud, because that cloud model has lots of positives and we've talked about those quite extensively, mm-hmm. but there are some negatives that people might think of. So the first one that I thought of was, you know, surely networking to the cloud is expensive. People are going to have to pay for significant bandwidth to get their data into the public cloud. Mm-hmm. How do you counter that when you sit with customers?
So I'll answer that two ways, right? So before I start answering cost questions, I'll just say that, you know, one of our mantras is that we can do what the other guys do for half the TCO.
Okay.
Right? And so we've figured all of these costs in. So having said that, there is a network component, right? There's a network cost component. But we would counter that with the cost components that they get to do away with, right?
Right.
All of the on-prem hardware and buying it, maintaining it, or if it's a virtual version in the cloud, they're still maintaining it and they're paying for that cloud resource and they're paying for it 24/7, whereas with us, they're paying for it, you know, hours a day.
Yeah. Okay. Another question I think people would be thinking is, and actually this one might not be as much of a big deal as we might think, and that's the idea of restores and egress charges.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, as data comes back out and goes back on-prem, for example, we'll talk about the cloud stuff separately, but coming back on-prem,
mm-hmm.
there's typically a charge to take data out of S3.
Yes.
So how does that get built into the equation?
So I have a question for you, Chris. Who pays the egress charges?
Well, there we go. So
the person whose Amazon account said thing is running in, right?
Yeah.
Which egress charges go to us, not to the customer.
Which is why, before I started saying the question, I'd already got my own answer in my head. But I thought, we still need to ask that question.
Absolutely. Our competitors have that problem, right?
Yes.
Because their products are running in the customer's account. So when you do a restore, you get a little extra pain at the end of Amazon charging you a big egress charge.
The one time that you probably don't need to be told that you're going to have to pay more money is when you know you've had to do a lot of restores.
Yeah, exactly.
It's probably the worst time to tell you, which is not great.
You're listening to Storage Unpacked.
So let's dig a bit deeper and talk about the implementation a little bit. And here we're talking about Phoenix, which is the typical enterprise workload type solution, not the endpoint piece here. So one of the things that I remember looking at when I looked at this solution originally was trying to get my head around what it might look like. So me being an old backup guy, not quite so, and actually, no, I think I am older than you, so I might
maybe,
be. Yeah.
Maybe.
So I remember the days of backup being huge servers that we would build.
Giant servers.
Tape libraries out the back.
Giant libraries. Giant tapes.
And masses of networking at the front.
Yeah.
And then going back, you know, really old, there used to be things like agents on service to pull that data out of the server. And then obviously as we moved to virtualization, that very much became the API in the hypervisor. Now, the one thing that we can see about that is that there was a data mover sitting there at some point
mm-hmm.
talking to the servers and extracting that data.
Right.
How does that equivalent look in the implementation of Phoenix?
So the data mover part, or the client part, is similar to, you know, any other system that you might buy.
Right. Okay.
You still have to have something that talks to the client being backed up.
Yep.
In the case of VMware Hyper-V, you're going to do it at the VMware level. You're going to put an OVA in there. You're going to use the VADP resources, right?
Okay.
And you're going to back up what we call agentless model. It's only agentless in the VM perspective, right? So you're running at the VMware or the Hyper-V level, and you're backing up VM. When it's physical servers, you're putting an agent on the server. If it's just Linux or Windows, it's just a standard agent. There's also a SQL Server and Oracle agents. But that perspective, it's from a really high level, it's the same as you would have. The way it behaves, however, is very different.
Okay.
And that is that we do what is referred to as source-side deduplication, right?
Okay. So yep.
There are other products that do that, but they're still, for some reason, in the minority, right? But we had the opportunity to redesign, to start from scratch, and to use that, and so that's what we did. And basically, it's a matter of chopping everything up into small segments. Those segments get a hash. That hash gets looked up, in our case, in DynamoDB. And if it's a hash we've seen before, we just don't send that block.
Okay.
If it's a hash we have seen before, we just notate that we have a new one. But it means that you asked earlier a question about bandwidth. We can do an awful lot of data over, you know, not that much of bandwidth because we're deduping from the very beginning.
Right.
Right. And number two, we are, to my knowledge, the only product that does global dedupe across a customer's entire environment, right? With no limitations, right? So we have multi-digit petabyte customers, so
okay.
Customers that are in the tens of petabytes that are globally deduplicating all that data together in one instance in one region.
Right.
Right. I don't know of any other dedupe product that does that.
So is that dedupe of just their data? You don't dedupe across multiple customers?
That dedupe is their data within that region.
Right. Okay.
So if you're using multiple regions, it's not deduping across that for obvious reasons because you can't restore.
But it would be deduped across multiple customer data centers that are hitting
multiple
the same region.
Multiple customer data sets, multiple customers' data centers,
yeah.
Multiple servers, even servers of different types. We don't care, you know, when you're doing hashes, a hash is a hash, right?
Okay. So that cuts down the traffic, and that's the sort of the level of things you need to put on the actual platform.
Yeah, which again, why does a customer care? It reduces bandwidth, and it reduces the amount of data stored in S3, which is what they get charged for.
Yeah. Is there any limitation on the platforms and sources of data you can take? Because clearly, there have been a lot of new products that have come out in the last sort of 3 or 4 years, and when they came out, they were very limited in the sense that they targeted hypervisors, and then they started to spread their support model out a lot more, and they did physical, and then they started to do database and so on. Is there any limit to
that's
what
sort
the scale
of
is?
That's sort
of
where we're at, right?
Okay.
So we started with VMware, Windows, and Linux. Now we've spread that to Hyper-V, Windows, and Linux.
Mm-hmm.
Also SQL Server and Oracle workloads,
okay.
Right? And then we're looking, I think we've discussed publicly that we do plan on doing full support for Nutanix as a hypervisor.
Right, okay, right? Interesting.
Right now we just do VM level backup, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can back up any VM, you know, as if it's a physical server, right? So we can do a VM in Azure or, you know, GCP or anything like that.
That was going to be my next question is, what does it look like in terms of the cloud? First of all, you've got an advantage in the sense that you'll be in the area that the customer's data is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But you, as you said, you treat instances as if they look like virtual machines.
If it's not VMware or Hyper-V, then we're going to treat that as if it's a physical machine.
Right. Okay.
Right. So what that means today is if it's an AWS native workload, we can protect it using native AWS tools, right? So
okay.
If it's either EC2 or Redshift or DynamoDB or something like that, we can protect that using native AWS tools. Today, within Azure or any other place there is a VM, we can protect that as a VM, right?
Right.
We would put our client on it. We don't yet have native protection for other things within Azure, but that is clearly something we're working on.
Okay, I'm just going to qualify what native means in the AWS scenario, and I'll tell you what I think think it means. If I'm thinking about, let's say, RDS or another solution, you're actually able to use the backup solution or other snapshot type technology that's supported by the API of that platform.
Correct.
And take the data from that source.
Correct. So in the case of AWS, so RDS, Redshift, S3, EC2, what they're able to do is create EBS snapshots, and then we're able to leverage those EBS snapshots to protect those platforms.
Right. So that sounds great. So now I sort of now have a visual model in my head of how that data is moving into the environment in the public cloud. What happens if the worst scenario occurs? A single server failure is probably pretty dramatic. Right. But what happens if I lose half a dozen servers? What happens when I have to do that big, I'm doing air quotes here, big restore back from the cloud?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two questions there. Obviously, you're going to ask this question in advance, and there are two answers to that question.
Yep.
If it's a few servers, piece of cake, and physics is actually in our favor. We've done competitive comparisons against other products, and even though we're in the cloud, we still end up doing a server restore faster than some of our competitors.
Right.
But if you're looking at an entire data center, now you basically have two choices. The best of those two choices, I would think, if we're talking a DR, is to use our optional DRAS service, right? DR as a service. And you're going to plan for that in advance. You're going to configure that. It's going to be in an Amazon VPC that is your account that you control.
Okay.
And you're going to install our cloud connector in that, because in order to do this, we need to unencrypt the data.
Yep.
Right?
You've got to bridge accounts effectively at that point.
And so once it's unencrypted, we don't want to see it. So that has to be in your account, right?
Yeah.
So you install the cloud connector. You do this initial configuration and we help guide you through it, where you're like, okay, this kind of VM should be that kind of VM and all that, because you're going to be running EC2 VMs, not VMware VMs.
Yeah.
Then basically what we do is you can either do it one time, or most of our customers do it on a very, automatically after they do a backup. They then convert that most recent backup into the running image that's going to be used for DR.
Okay.
Right? And we can do that as often as every hour. And if you declare a disaster, it takes us roughly 15 to 20 minutes to get that most recent image converted into an AMI image.
From what point you can then spin that up as an actual instance in Amazon itself?
And all of that is completely automated. So we advertise, we call it one click fail over, and very soon one click fail back, right? Back is just as important as fail over.
Yeah.
A lot of companies, including ours, came out with DR with just fail over, and you need to be able to fail back. And we, within the next, maybe by the time this podcast comes out, it may be live or really close to live.
Really close to it.
And I do want to mention there, we changed a few months ago how we do DR. And this has been a really big change for us.
Okay.
So up until a few months ago, we did what everybody else does. We restore the VMDK, and then we run AWS import on it. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's how we convert from, VMDK to AMI. The problem with that is it's not a DR tool. It was never designed for that. And it is not built for speed.
Yeah.
Right. It's a bit of a pickup.
Yes.
Right. And so it takes 4 hours plus to do that conversion. And the bigger the VM, the longer the conversion. And so up until a few months ago, we were looking at a 4-hour RTO.
Right. Okay.
But we figured out that there's actually not a lot of difference between a VMDK and an AMI. And we do what I'll call surgery on the VMDK to actually surgically alter it into an AMI rather than run it through that conversion.
Okay. And you support that in the sense that you know how that now works. And therefore, if a customer has an issue, they would come to you and you would support that transition.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's really quite an interesting scenario, because we talk about backup and DR a lot of the time in a similar manner, and I think sometimes that's a mistake. So, and the reason I say that is because obviously I picked a scenario where I said there, what happens if you have to do that big restore?
Right.
Now, if you look at historically at the way that we did backup and restore, say to tape or even to dedupe libraries, you couldn't do a full spectrum restore of hundreds of servers from those platforms.
No.
Anyway,
no,
so you
no.
know, you always had a secondary recovery mechanism, like you replicated the
storage. And that's always been a huge waste.
Yeah.
Right? You have two systems that do essentially the same thing, just in different ways. This way you don't, right? Which is another way we can help lower customers' TCO, right?
Yeah.
And to just round out, so basically that product, the DRAS product, it's 15 to 20 minutes and you're up and running, right? With a 1 hour, so 15 to 20 minute RTO, 1 hour RPO. The other option is to do a reverse seed, right? Which is not in the product today, but it's going to be here very soon, and it's going to use Snowball Edge.
Okay.
There you go.
Good. So, I think that side of it is really quite an interesting challenge, that whole idea of, do I build a complete DR solution that looks entirely like my primary solution? I've worked in lots of places, I'm sure you have, where you effectively bought double everything. Yeah. And sometimes you might have said, when it was physical servers, you might have said, oh yeah, we'll use the DR one as a test dev box or something like that. But then when you start looking at virtualization, you still have to have two lots of equipment because you still have to have the capacity to take both workloads onto one site or the other. So ultimately, you are always wasting resource. And that gets us right back to the very beginning of this discussion where we were saying, why cloud?
Yeah.
And
DR is the perfect workload for the cloud because it's something that hopefully you never do, but you test on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Right? So you need it a couple of days a year, and why pay for it any other time than that?
I remember, I'm trying to think back to who it was. I think it might have been SunGuard in the UK. Mm-hmm. Maybe I shouldn't say that there's a name, but I've said it now. So
we have it over here as well.
But I'm sure that when some of the DR stuff we used to do on the mainframe in those days, we would have a contract that either guaranteed we would have a machine when we went DR, which cost one price, or we could share a machine and hope that...
I hope you don't get a run on the bank.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's one thing that the cloud actually avoids. So SunGuard had a great model in the sense that you're sharing DR equipment and therefore you're not paying for it fully.
Right.
But you were always at that risk of what happens if somebody else has already gone before you have. Yeah. Whereas cloud doesn't have that scenario because the economies of scale mean there'll always be resources available for you.
Exactly.
So that's pretty good. We've looked at the idea of why using the cloud. We've looked at what the actual solution would look like once you've actually deployed it. But what becomes really obvious is once you've actually collected this data, and this data is now sitting in a format you can do something with it, you're now in the perfect place where you have tools and you have features and products that you can use to do other things on that data.
Right, right.
So there's an opportunity here to say, I can actually analyze that data and do other things with it.
Right.
So how far are you down that route, and what do you offer in terms of the ability to actually mine that data for some other purpose?
So we are partly down that route, but we think it depends on how you answer the question. In some sense, I think we're farther down than some of our competitors.
Okay.
Right? In other sense, I think our competitors are ahead of us, right?
Okay.
So they may have more products that they're doing this with, more workloads or ways of analyzing data, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where I think we're ahead is that we already have the data where it needs to be, right? So our competitors are all storing the data in on premises, right?
Yeah.
And if you're going to do analytics, some of them are trying to do the analytics in the server. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. But it means, again, that designing for the peak problem gets worse. So now you need even more peak because you need enough peak for backups and enough peak for analytics or whatever else it is you're going to do, right?
Yeah.
It's not wrong inherently, but we're thinking that if you're going to do other interesting things like analytics, rediscovery, or ransomware detection, things like that, you want peak capacity and things, and you want to do that in the cloud. We already have the data in the cloud where some of our competitors have to move it up in the cloud to do that, right? So that's where I think we're ahead.
Yep.
We have already on the endpoint side, we're farther ahead than we are on the data center side with this type of stuff, right? So for example, things like ransomware detection is a great thing. So we have like machine learning to look for ransomware and then to stop that, provide notification and then provide remedy to stop that. Things like e-discovery, rather than having to make a giant egress of data, egress with a small e, a giant egress of data out of your backup system to hand over to your discovery thing, we can do the culling first within our tool and then hand that over to an e-discovery service provider, then they can automatically connect that data directly to the data and pull out what they need.
Just what they need,
and provide all the searches that they want to do against that.
Yeah.
And we see the other workloads, the other ideas of other things that people are doing with like the big data type analytics, and we are working with those providers. That's definitely our product direction. And we think that the fact that we've already got the data where it needs to be so that their customers can use those SaaS tools to analyze their data and they don't have to pay extra storage charges to do so.
In fact, actually, I think you're in probably a little step further than some other customers in this instance, some other vendors in this instance. And the reason I say that is because you've already built an environment which you deliver your services for data protection as SaaS.
Right.
So you've already built the infrastructure that bills the customer, accounts for their usage and all of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you, for instance, could offer those analytics features and compliance and everything we've just described as services that the customer just buys. Right. So the customer doesn't even have to think, I'm the one who's going to have to build this analytics engine to do X.
Right, right.
You could just sell that service to them directly and charge them for the usage of that because you've already got that IP and infrastructure in place to allow that process to work.
Yeah, which we're already doing with some of the tools.
Right, okay. Right?
And we do use, depending on the thing we're talking about, we may use an external tool if it's the best thing to do that.
Yeah.
But we just then include that as part of the price of our service.
Okay. Right. So can we expect more of those to come along later? I mean, is that an ongoing
evolution?
Absolutely,
with a capital A.
Okay.
Can I tell you what the names of them are or anything like that?
You can tell me anything you like, yeah. We want to make a big list, shall we?
They you know, since I talk so much to the public, they keep me far away from, you know, the skunk work stuff.
Yeah.
But there's a whole team of people who are looking at that kind of stuff.
Okay. So I see that option of adding additional features as being quite valuable. But in general, where is the business as it is today? Because what did we say? We said 6 years of moving into being enterprise.
Right.
10 years of being generally in the industry. Where has the company got to?
So we're a SaaS provider, right? So
yeah.
We compare ourselves to a Salesforce or to, you know, that sort of thing. The thing that matters for a SaaS provider is 100% annual recurring revenue, right? And where we have gotten to is we're approaching $100 million in annual recurring revenue, which is a very solid, very respectable number.
Absolutely.
You know, we've had a very solid compounded annual growth rate over the last several years. And we see that moving forward.
Yeah.
I wondered when I came on board, right? Because Druva doesn't have one of the biggest brands in the space. I wondered if we were going to be one of those companies that has really cool technology that nobody buys. Because I'm sure you've run into a few of those.
There are plenty of those sort of companies.
There's plenty of those companies.
Yeah.
And we're clearly not one of those companies, right? I think a number of people are going to be surprised at how big we actually are.
Yeah. I think 100 million is a big number, and especially when you think of it in terms of purely SaaS. I mean, there's the differentiation.
Yeah.
You're not selling software directly. You're not selling hardware directly.
Yeah.
So that's pure subscription-based revenue that you've had to get that
and
from.
And for those that don't follow the space, explain how big of a deal that is, right? So, you know, you can look at other companies, right? You know, I'll even mention Rubrik. They're doing very well, and they've gone well over $300 million in revenue.
Yeah.
But in January 1, they have to sell another $300 million in revenue to maintain, and they have to sell more to grow.
Yes.
We're annual recurring revenue.
Yeah.
When we start our fiscal year, we're at 80% done for the growth rate that we want to do at the next year, right?
Yeah.
So all we have to do is add a little bit, and we have growth. And you add to that also the fact that we have 121% retention rate of customer data, meaning that for every dollar that a customer spends today, they're going to spend $1.20 next year.
Right. Okay. Right? I was just trying to work out how you could be more than 100%.
Yeah. How more than 100%. Yeah. So yeah. Basically, and that figures in attrition, right? So including attrition and including customers to stay with us, on average, if we, you know, sell a dollar to a customer this year, they're going to spend $1.20 with us next year.
Right.
So we get 20% growth without doing anything.
Before even starting.
Right.
Yeah.
So we just have to sell another 20% and we're a 40% compound annual growth rate.
Fantastic.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So we covered a huge amount there, some of which I think people might want to go back over in more detail, maybe want to dig in, or even, you know, we might have convinced somebody that they should just turn around and start buying you from tomorrow. Where can people find out more? I don't know whether people know how to stalk you personally. I mean, I'm sure they must do because you have quite a lot of people following you on Twitter. But say people wanted to stalk you personally, Curtis, or actually just wanted to look to see where the technology is and learn a bit more, where should they go?
Yeah, so I am at WC Preston on Twitter. My personal blog is backupcentral.com, which has been out there for, wow.
Well, before the internet.
Two decades.
Yeah,
of blog history on there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Druva.com. And the product that we've been mainly talking about today is Phoenix, which is the data center product. There you go.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks for your time. It's been a great discussion. Look forward to catching up soon. And thanks very much.
Glad to be here.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.